It might be quiet at the Capitol, but there's still business at the Iowa State House. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. It's Legislative Monday, and while we focus a lot on the big three issues, at the end of the session, there's a lot of smaller bills that fly under the radar. Today, we'll talk about a bill that would require online businesses to collect sales tax, and another one that requires DNA testing for certain convictions. In the second half, we'll peel back the gold dome and take a look at the day-to-day life here at the Capitol with people who aren't lawmakers. Join our conversation after this news. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. State lawmakers have blown past their targeted adjournment when expenses run out, legislative clerks and pages have gone home for the summer, and the big three issues of property taxes, ensuring low-income Iowans, and education reform are being hammered out in conference committees and in leader meetings behind closed doors. But the legislative gears are still turning. In the first part of today's show, we wanted to talk about a couple bills we haven't spent much time talking about. The first one, if you are a regular buyer of items online, you'll probably want to pay attention. A bill that has seemingly little to no opposition would collect state taxes for items purchased online. It's similar to a national bill that passed the U.S. Senate last week. The CEO of eBay last week on Morning Edition talked about how the national bill would hurt small business owners that sell online because they would be forced to know about every state's sales tax models. Here to shed some light on the subject is Victoria Daniels, a lobbyist and legislative liaison with the Department of Revenue. Welcome, Victoria.
Good afternoon.
So are you a small business owner that sells online? Do you think this would hurt or help your business? Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or reach out to us on Facebook. We're at Iowa Public Radio. So Victoria, first of all, describe a little bit about the national bill and what it looks like here in Iowa.
Okay. The national bill that is alive right now is called the Marketplace Fairness Act. And it is basically granting authority to states to collect sales tax remotely. That's not just internet. That could be catalog sales. But anytime that you don't have a physical presence in the state, you're not the state cannot enforce its sales tax laws upon you. So this would the Marketplace Fairness Act would give states the authority to do that if they meet minimum simplification requirements and comply with all the other requirements.
And that minimum is?
Well, there is a small seller exception of $1 million. So if you have less than $1 million in total sales, you're not going to be impacted by this federal law if it passes.
If it passes. And it's passed the U.S. Senate. It looks to have more of an uphill climb in the House.
Correct. That's what everyone is telling me, that the Senate passage was clearly a victory for the movement, but it's going to be a little bit rougher in the House.
And so how does it look at the state level? And what happens here? Does it hinge upon what happens at the national level?
No, absolutely not. In fact, there are a couple different things that we do to address the situation at the state level. The first one, I would say, is more related to the federal bill, and that is Iowa's participation in the Streamlined Sales Tax Project. We've been participants since 2005, and that is a group of states that agree to adopt minimum simplification and standardization rules for their sales tax. And then in return, retailers volunteer to collect the sales tax remotely because they know if they're selling into one of these states, they're going to be using similar principles and similar rules, and that makes it easier for them.
So there wouldn't be 50 different sales tax codes if all states were working together in the streamline. How many people are, or how many states rather, are participating in the streamline project, as you mentioned?
Over half of the states that have a sales tax, which not all states do, currently participate in the project and have adopted these minimum simplification standards. And you know, there are always going to be differences. Believe me, there are still areas that can be different from state to state, but in general, they follow the same rules, and it's easier for businesses really if they have the business in a lot of different states because they can just file one return rather than 50 different returns.
I'll go to a call now from Jim in Spencer. Jim, you're on River to River.
Yes. Well, I think it's only fair. I think that, you know, no one has forced these businesses to use this method of marketing. And I think that, you know, they were given a free ride for a number of years. And that, you know, if they're anything like most Internet companies, when you log on to their site, they're going to have you do all the clerical work, fill out all the forms anyway. So I do really doubt that it's going to cost them a lot of money to collect those additional fees if they're clever. They're going to have their customers just do all the paperwork for them like they do right now.
Jim, do you buy a lot online?
I buy a little bit online, but see, you know, what most people don't realize is that they're supposed to pay a use tax anyway. And so this really isn't a tax increase at all. And, you know, in these times when our economies, our state budgets are straining, there's no reason why anybody should get a free ride.
Okay. Well, thanks, Jim. And Victoria, he brings up the thought that we have a consumer use tax where customers should report the tax money on their items when they're buying online. Is there a way to know who is buying online and how much to tax them right now?
No. Absent sending a person to every Iowan's doorstep, which obviously we would not want to do. It's one of the difficulties we've encountered in trying to come up with a fiscal estimate for what the federal legislation could bring into the state. We simply don't know.
So how much of a burden does this place on small businesses? The CEO of eBay has been pretty outspoken against the national legislation because it forces more work on small businesses. Do you see a situation there where it would create more of a burden on small businesses?
Well, I think it may be something new that they have to do, but I see two problems with that argument. Number one, the $1 million threshold. The last version of this bill last year only had a $500,000 threshold, and it has been discussed to be as low as $250,000. The higher that threshold is, the more your smaller businesses are going to be excluded from that federal legislation. And secondly, there are a number of software companies and other entrepreneurial types that simply cannot wait for this federal legislation to pass so that they can offer the service of assisting these businesses with knowing about the different tax laws that they need to know.
And at the state level, at what point – well, I guess, how long has it been that this argument or this conversation has been happening at the state level, whether or not to charge sales tax for online purchasing? Is this an ongoing issue, and how far has it gotten in the past compared to now?
I think the issue really started to heat up in the 90s with the Quill case in the Supreme Court that said that only Congress could make this collection authority happen, basically. And the thing that we've seen since that time is remote sales, in particular, internet sales, have just grown exponentially. Yes, the consumer's use tax liability has always been there, but now people are feeling it because you see all these statistics about how much people are buying online. Everybody knows they want to buy everything online nowadays. And so now when everybody's budget is crunched, I think states have been taking a harder look at it. But this is the closest that we have ever come to having federal legislation.
If it is passed at a national level, how will Iowa fare for implementation?
Iowa is well positioned simply by the fact that we are a participant in the Streamlined Sales Tax Project and a member state of the governing board and have been doing so since 2005. We know that there will be some software and system changes that we would need to implement, but we're ready to tackle those when and if the federal legislation passes. And we also have 180 days to fully implement once the bill passes.
So you probably don't want to speculate too much, but likelihood of this passing at the state level?
The state bill?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's House File 226, which, you know, similar but not addressing the same issues as the federal bill. Just want to make that clear.
Mm-hmm.
It's been placed on the calendar for unfinished business in the House, which means it's still alive. They could take it up and vote on it this session, or they could take it up again next year even. But I honestly don't know.
Well, Victoria, thanks for being here to shed some light on the sales tax bill. And you're going to stick around with us for the second half, so we appreciate that. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters, and we're switching gears now to a bill that's ready to be signed by Governor Branstad. The bill would require people convicted of an aggravated misdemeanor to submit a DNA sample. Critics are concerned it's a slippery slope, that it'll snowball and everyone's DNA will be taken, that it's more personal than, say, fingerprints. Here to talk about how the law would impact Iowans are Bobby Raykemper. He's a criminal defense attorney and member of the Iowa Association of Justice. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Thomas H. Miller, Deputy Attorney General here in Iowa. Welcome to you, too.
Good afternoon, Clay.
We also want to hear from you. Does this bill make you feel safer, or does it infringe on your rights? Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. We're also on Facebook, Iowa Public Radio. So first of all, Thomas, if you'd tell us a little bit about what this bill would do and mean for your department.
The bill is for law enforcement in general, and what it does by adding the number of criminals who are have their DNA entered the DNA profile bank, it promotes the integrity and credibility of the criminal justice system by enhancing the speed and reliability of the process by which the guilty are convicted and the innocent are exonerated.
So this you see this as helping law enforcement do a better job?
Yes, it brings modern science into the courtroom. It helps us get further and further away from relying upon the sometimes faulty memories of witnesses and bringing science into the courtroom with the advantage of an objective determination as to who committed and who did not commit a crime.
Bobby, you see things a little bit differently. How do you see this legislation or this bill when it's signed into law impacting the citizens of Iowa?
I think the modern advances in science are always going to be available for law enforcement, whether this bill exists or not. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest concern that this bill raises is it expands the net of and reach of people who, in essence, have to have their genetic coding on file into infinity. For purposes of investigations or whatever the government chooses to do in the future. So you have the privacy concerns. You also have the fiscal responsibility concerns associated with, is this program effective? Is it a wise use of taxpayer money when you look at the numbers that it's going to cost, not just to keep it the way it is, but to expand it for misdemeanor convictions like this?
And so what kind of misdemeanors does this, when we talk about aggravated misdemeanor, what does that include?
It includes almost all. Well, the aggravated misdemeanor, it's the top level of misdemeanors in Iowa, but aggravated misdemeanors include, for example, theft in the third degree. It includes things like criminal mischief in the third degree. My favorite is it also includes using an unregistered brand on a livestock you own. Things like that that some people may not understand. It also does encompass also OWI second offense, so long as a person has a few prior suspensions or public intoxication, third offense, things like that, that I think if a reasonable person looks at would probably say it's not that type of offense that would necessitate putting your DNA on file.
Thomas, how do you reply to that?
Well, first of all, the legislature excluded some aggravated misdemeanors from a list of those that qualify under this bill. Among those are gaming offenses, hazardous waste offenses, and animal facility offenses. Aggravated misdemeanors are punishable by 2 years in prison, generally nationwide, and in the federal system, anything that's punishable by a year or more in prison is considered a felony. So this still is less inclusive than that of many states and the federal government. The confidentiality issue is addressed in the bill. There are strict provisions for confidentiality that are comparable to those relating to medical records. And finally, and I think very importantly, the fiscal issue, there is a great financial and personal toll that is taken by having serious crimes, rapes and murders and the like go unsolved for years on end. It takes a great toll on the victims and the victim survivors, but the cost of putting one profile on the database is relatively minimal, whereas the cost savings of having heinous crimes rapidly solved is unknown and pretty hard to put a value on.
And it was interesting, too, you saw in the Senate vote there were Republicans and Democrats on either side of the issue. I'm curious, is the act of collecting DNA for judicial purposes unprecedented, or are there similar records currently in place?
Well, we have fingerprint records of everyone who's arrested for anything whatsoever. This is far more restrictive in what law enforcement can do by insisting that an individual be actually found guilty of a serious crime before his DNA is collected for the profile bank. The broad spectrum of bipartisan support for the bill, I think, simply stems from the realistic observation that we need to take advantage in law enforcement, as we do in all other area where science can assist us in arriving at accurate, truthful decisions. The costs of waiting and waiting and waiting not only are imposed upon the victims and their loved ones, but also upon people who may live under a cloud of suspicion. The quick determination of responsibility based upon a DNA hit avoids both of those unfortunate consequences.
River to River listeners, we want to hear from you. Does this bill make you feel more safe? Does it infringe on your rights? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio. And Bobby, if there was a guarantee that DNA sampling would not move from convicted criminals to the general population, would you support it?
No.
No? Why is that?
Because there's a line that has to be drawn at some point, and what you're doing by this DNA sampling is you're performing a search of the human body, and you're performing a search of the human body for use later on without any suspicion of other criminal activity at all. So you're saying, thank you, we're going to take your genetic profile. We're going to save it just in case you become a suspect later on. Why not do that at birth? Why not do that to get your driver's license? And so the privacy interests aren't outweighed by the effectiveness of DNA profiling. You have to look at it and say, what case in the state of Iowa has been solved or if somebody has been convicted because of this great database that they claim we have? I don't know of any. Maybe they can point out one or two. But the other concern is when you look at the privacy interest the person is giving up, what they can get the same information pursuant to a search warrant if they can provide enough suspicion to a judge to have that search warrant signed. So it's not that they don't have the tools already at their disposal. The most effective way to solve these heinous crimes, as they're referred to, is thorough and effective police work, not having some magical database that everybody looks at thinking it has a CSI effect, which it really doesn't.
Thomas, are there instances where there are cases that a database has helped prevent something from happening or helped lead to the arrest of someone?
Just most recently, the case of State of Iowa versus Eugene Pilcher was brought to court. It is still a pending trial, but I can tell you that he is accused of a murder that occurred in the mid-1970s. That his identification occurred because of a CODIS hit, in other words, an identification based upon his having committed another crime years ago, compared with the with his scene at the crime DNA, and that but for that profile on file, this case would not have been solved. The young lady in question was 17 years old and has been dead now for well over 20 years, but her mother survives, and it is important to her and to all surviving relatives of cases of rape and murder such as this one that they be solved whenever they can be solved.
So when we talk about DNA sampling, essentially one of these misdemeanors happens, somebody's taken in. How do you collect their DNA? What would the process be like?
Yes, the collection of DNA is actually less intrusive than the collection of a fingerprint. The collector takes a cotton swab, Q-tip, very similar to a Q-tip, and spends approximately 2 seconds rubbing it on the inside of the suspect's cheek. Sample is then submitted for profiling, and the profile is included in the nationwide database. And in the event that person commits a crime that leaves his DNA at the scene, he can be identified quickly. The fingerprinting process, by contrast, is one that takes quite a bit longer and involves a pretty messy job of trying to clean up afterwards. So as far as the actual hardship on the person whose DNA is being collected, it's relatively slight.
So, Bobby, what do you make of the argument that we seem to hear from people opposing it, that it does open the door to, for everyone getting their DNA taken? Is that a step that you see happening next since we've opened that door?
Well, why not? I mean, if it's such an effective police tool, why not expand it? They've already expanded it from felonies. Iowa did not start out like a lot of states, which is specifically limiting it to violent felonies to have the DNA taken. They started off with all felonies, and I believe it's been in effect since about 2005. And now we're moving to aggravated misdemeanors with the exception of animal facility violations and small gambling violations. So we're expanding it slowly but surely. And the next logical step will be serious misdemeanors. The next logical step from there will be simple misdemeanors or traffic violations. And ultimately, why not? You know, if their argument is it makes for better law enforcement, and we're going to put aside the privacy concerns, just take it at birth.
Well, don't you think lawmakers would eventually say, okay, well, hold up, let's not keep going on? You think that if the argument is made that it's for lesser and lesser crimes, that lawmakers would be open to that?
Well, if it solves one case, then it's worth it, right? I mean, that's the argument that we hear on the other side. And for those people involved in that case, certainly. But the issue is bigger than that. The issue is a privacy concern that is weighed against a program that just for the expansion to aggravated misdemeanors is going to cost taxpayers approximately $327,000 a year on top of what they're already paying.
Thomas, when this becomes law, you're saying that this is going to help law enforcement do their job better. Tell us a little bit about some of the ways that this will help. We've talked about some of them, but I'm curious to hear more.
It will result in a cost savings in the long run by quickly resolving criminal cases. The time that is spent in a major crime, and it's a sexual assault or a murder, involves enormous application of man hours. And in those cases where a transfer of bodily fluids has occurred with a large database, the guilty can relatively quickly be identified and, conversely and equally importantly, the innocent eliminated. The law is currently written, only takes DNA samples from people who have been found guilty of crimes. The slippery slope, which is the argument of ACLU and others, is one that is under the watchful eye of the legislature, and as we've seen even in the last session, even aggravated misdemeanors have been excluded where protection of people convicted of hazardous waste offenses, for example, were excluded. We know that these civil liberties are at the top of the agenda of many, if not most, members of our legislature, and I certainly see no reason to assume that that will change.
Okay, well, that's where we're going to have to end the conversation today. Thanks so much to my guests, Bobby Rainkemper and Thomas H. Miller. We're going to come back after the break, and we're going to talk more about just what goes on in the day-to-day life at the State House as we're trying to wrap things up here. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. It's Legislative Monday, and just about every conversation that takes place here at the Capitol these days always goes back to speculation on when the session will end. The targeted day for adjournment was May 3rd. Before the show, I was out in the rotunda, coming into the law library, pretty quiet. A group of elementary school students were taking a tour, really quiet here. Usually it's crowded with lobbyists, lawmakers, and their staff, so we wanted to do something a bit different for the second part of today's River to River. While lawmakers are hammering out the details of these three big issues, we've invited a couple lobbyists here, as well as the governor's communications director, to talk about daily life at the Capitol. Here with me in the State House Law Library is Tim Albrecht. He's the Communications Director for Governor Branstad. Welcome back, Tim.
Thank you, Clay.
And Scott Sundstrom, an attorney with Nyemaster Good Law Firm in Des Moines and a shareholder in the firm's Governmental Affairs Department. Scott, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Victoria Daniels, a lobbyist and legislative liaison with the Iowa Department of Revenue, who joined us for the first part. She's back. Thanks for being with us, Victoria.
My pleasure.
River to River listeners, do you ever wonder what's going on up here at the Capitol or have some thoughts, some stories? Maybe you worked here once upon a time. Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Reach out to us on Facebook, Iowa Public Radio. So, Tim, we'll start with you. I'm just curious, the governor travels all over the state, but you seem to be tied down here at the Capitol. Give us an idea of what daily life is like here in the governor's office when he's out running around the state.
Well, the advantage to the governor's term this time, as opposed to his first four terms in the 80s and 90s, is the advent of the cell phone, the smartphone, so he can go anywhere in the state. Occasionally, there might be a little blackout place, but he doesn't have to go find a payphone in order to check back with the staff. So what he does is he will give his staff pretty broad leverage in terms of these negotiations. Chief of Staff Jeff Boink, Department of Management Head Dave Roederer, who oversees the budget, both are tasked on his behalf with negotiating with both House and Senate leadership. So at the staff level, a lot is occurring while everything seems calm and quiet upstairs. And, you know, the rumor mill goes amongst the lobbyists and the legislators, and they wonder what's happening and what's occurring. But really, the undercurrent underneath all that is a bunch of busy staff people putting everything together, negotiating in good faith on behalf of their bosses.
So when the big boss comes back to town, you guys kind of have a quorum and talk about what has happened since he's been gone? Or how does that, I mean, is he riding around with his smartphone?
The big boss is constantly kept apprised of what's going on in the Capitol, and he works with the chief of staff and the Department of Management Head to ensure that his priorities are being met. He always has a staff member with him, so it's never a problem to get in a hold of a staff member that might happen to be with him or he himself, because Iowa's a very big state. He covers all 99 counties every year, so there's a lot of windshield time for him to call back.
So are you meeting regularly yourself, people on the staff, with lobbyists and special interest groups to talk about what's at stake in the session? Or
in terms of the communications aspect, we want to make sure that the governor's voice is being heard and that his position on every single issue is well represented when those media come to me. So what I do is I can convey those positions and sort of the progress of the negotiations. And I do that by meeting with all of our policy staff on a regular basis, the chief of staff, head of the Department of Management, so that I know what exactly is occurring and that we're conveying what needs to be conveyed.
Scott, you have a bit different of a role coming to the Capitol every day. Your office might be a table in the cafeteria area or up on one of the benches. Tell me a little bit about how things have changed since you came here and all the different interests that you're representing.
Yeah, this is my ninth session, and so I'm certainly not a brand newbie, but I'm not by any stretch the most senior lobbyist at the Capitol. But even in 9 years, things have changed quite a bit. The most prominent is the growth of the internet and the availability of bills, amendments, and other information about the legislative process on the legislative website. When I first started every day, the first thing we'd do when we got to the Capitol was we would get a bill packet that had a copy of all the bills and amendments that were filed the previous day. And that would be the first chance we got to look at the bills and amendments. And we'd read through that and get up to date on what was going on. Now what we do is the bills and amendments that are filed on a particular day are available almost in real time, but all of them are collected by early in the evening. And so it is the evening of the day of the bills and amendments are filed is when we're looking at them and keeping track of the new development. So the timeline has moved up, and I can do it at my desk at home rather than having to come in and get a big stack of paper. In fact, we don't even pay for the paper anymore. We've saved some trees and some money in the process.
Victoria, do you see things pretty similarly to the way that Scott's set it up?
Absolutely. I'm definitely more of a rookie. This is only my sixth session, but certainly access is much better through the Legislative Services Agency's website, and you really do have almost immediate access to those bills, so you can study them and try to figure out who you need to talk to find out what's going on.
Are there bills that you guys have been following very closely this session and how have you tracked them? Especially, Scott, you have a long list of clients, and I would lose my mind trying to remember who all I'm serving and how to follow what interest in each bill.
Well, we have several ways of trying to follow things. I mean, one, as a lobbyist, you're legally required to register your position on every bill for every client, either for, against, or undecided if you're just monitoring it. So we do that formally, and all that's available on the legislative website if anyone ever wants to look it up. If you're having trouble sleeping, that's
people just hanging out.
Sort of the equivalent to counting sheep, I guess.
Right.
We also maintain a database internally at our office of all the bills with a little more detail about what's going on with the bill. We do constantly track the bills and the status. There's different ways of doing that, both on the website and then talking to legislators and following the meeting progress and so on. So there are a number of bills that I've worked on this session. I lobby for the Iowa Grocery Industry Association. There's been a bottle bill expansion bill, which is obviously of very great significance for that client, and watch that one very closely. Talk to legislators about what's happening with it and, you know, our thoughts on it. So there are lots of bills like that. I mean, that's one of the great challenges, especially early in the session, because so many bills are filed, and just making sure that you're aware of all of them, keeping track of the fact that they're filed, what they say, where they are in the process, takes constant attention. But
I can speak to that, too, because this is my first legislative session that I've covered here in Iowa, and it took me quite a while to get the process down and to figure it out. I mean, is there ever a time where it's, I mean, intimidating by the amount of information that's coming out and keeping it all straight? I mean, you know, a stapled packet sounds pretty nice sometimes when you think about Twitter.
Yeah, it is intimidating. It really is. Yeah, and I think that's a good point, too, the social network aspect of communication. I mean, the volume of information about the legislative session is tremendous. You know, even in a relatively small state like Iowa, there's just a huge volume of information, both substantive information, political information, policy information, and trying to keep abreast of all of that is quite a challenge. But it also is fun, too, because you really, I think the public, to the extent they're interested, they have a chance to become more engaged through all those different channels of information should they want to do that.
And Victoria, with representing the Department of Revenue, there's kind of a more of a focus there. Are there bills that you've been paying close attention to, and how have you followed those through the process?
Have you heard about property tax?
I have. It seems to be one of those big issues.
No, any bill that has a tax or a fee that we administer, any type of a fiscal impact on the state, we're up here to provide information to the legislators and to the governor's office about what the impact would be. We work with Legislative Services Agency to develop the fiscal estimates for those bills. And then we do put forth some bills of our own, usually technical corrections, recommendations for a way that tax policy can be improved or made more consistent. There's no shortage of things that we're tracking, and it takes a lot of people to make that come together. Then once the session ends, we just have to figure out how to make it happen.
And, you know, there seems to be this, there's so much polarization as far as politics go these days. Do you feel any different talking across party lines to the way that you talk with different senators, or is it, are they all just kind of, this is the job, they know how to do it, they're all the same?
You know, it depends on the issue. I mean, for the clients that I represent are generally a lot of trade associations or businesses. Their issues are not partisan, in the sense that maybe social issues, you know, that become very partisan and you know, raise the temperature in the room. That's not the stuff, thankfully, that I'm working on, where there really is a different approach, I think, if you're talking to a Republican or a Democrat. It does differ if a legislator is in the majority or a minority party. I mean, you know, the majority party makes the decisions, and so they're usually the first person you'll talk to on an issue. And sometimes the approaches on an issue, maybe you'll know that a particular legislator is very interested in a certain aspect of state government, a certain type of policy, and you might try to connect the issue to that if that's possible, so that they, you know, they understand it in that sense, you know, something that interests them, they'll naturally pay more attention.
And you've worked for Victoria, you've worked for different administrations too, so you've had to take a bipartisan way of doing business.
Absolutely. Every day we provide the same information to everybody regardless of who they are. We're a neutral agency by nature, and we try to be fair with everybody that we talk to and give them the information we can, as long as it's not confidential. But I think one important thing that I've figured out, you really have to understand what a person's perspective is going to be when you approach them. And that's something that you pick up over time, I think. You learn the different personalities, and then you can figure out how someone is going to react or respond to something, and you try to tailor your message and your talking points to those different personalities and beliefs, I think.
And Tim, you've had the unique perspective of from 2002 to 2007, you were the communications director for the Speaker of the House. So you've seen multiple bodies doing work. And how are things different for you in the House than they were in the than they are in the governor's office?
Well, one thing that never changes from session to session to session is the fact that there seems to be this rush at the end to get something done. And what happens is it feels like a dam breaks, and then all of a sudden this water comes rushing in and people say, oh my God, what happened? You know, where did this legislation come from? When in reality, what you have to convey is, you know, behind that dam was the water, and then it just is in a different place now, but it's the same water. And to Scott's point, there's so many opportunities to learn about legislation, to contact your state representative, because now, you know, state representatives, they still have the email and the phone, but you've got Twitter, you've got a Facebook wall, you have all these different opportunities to really reach out and have an impact on legislation. And I think it's important for every Iowan who's concerned with any particular issue to do so.
But at the same time, there's not a whole lot, you know, unless they're the Speaker of the House or the majority leader in the Senate, there's not a whole lot that can be talked about at this point.
Well, that's correct. And that's why a lot of people say, well, this issue might be dead, when the governor always says no issue is dead until the sine die, the final gavel falls. But that's true. And legislators work very hard at this. I remember when I worked for Christopher Rantz, who was Speaker of the House, he had a Republican majority in the Senate, but he had a Democratic governor in Governor Vilsack. And Rantz would stay up till 3-4 in the morning, maybe sometimes all night. He'd always wear himself sick at the end of session, but he just worked so hard to find that compromise that's needed when you have a divided chamber.
And with the divided chamber in the remaining how many ever weeks that the session goes on, isn't it in lobbyists' best interests just to stick around? I mean, because it's pretty quiet out there. I mean, wouldn't you at least I would think that it would be of best interest to, while these big deals are getting hammered out, to be there in case the unknown happens.
Yeah, that is definitely true. I think one of the things we try to do, there are three lawyers at my law firm who are in our lobbying government relations practice, and we try to have somebody here all the time when they're, at least one of us, usually all three of us are here all the time when they're gaveled in. And even on days like this where it's seemingly very quiet, we will almost always come up here and at least sort of take the temperature and see what we can find out, talk to some people and see what rumors you can pick up and discard about half of them, but the other half might be helpful. Yeah,
just start some rumors. Yeah, exactly. Victoria?
Yeah, I'm fortunate because I just work right across the street in the Hoover Building, so I can come over at a moment's notice. But yeah, you don't want to not keep your eye on the ball. This is when things are really happening, and you need to be, in my case, available to provide information if you're asked, and you need to know what's happening.
Yeah, it really is amazing just being in the Capitol, being physically present here. A stray conversation when you happen to bump into a legislator can be immensely helpful on issues to provide input or to learn something, and those things you can't plan. You don't really schedule meetings up here as a lobbyist. That's not the way this place works. The schedules are incredibly fluid. There's a huge amount of just randomness that goes on, and by being here all the time, you can really take advantage of that and try to minimize the problems with schedules blowing up all the time around here.
River to River listeners, curious about what's going on at the Capitol on a day-to-day basis, especially when the session is trying to wrap up, give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. Maybe you have an interesting story to talk about when you worked here. Maybe you were a page. Tweet us at IPR Talk or reach out to us at Facebook, Iowa Public Radio. And it's interesting, too, you know, all these senators have jobs that they have to get back to, or these representatives have to get back to their districts. Whereas in both of your shoes, Scott and Victoria, this is your life. I mean, you spend the rest of the year, I mean, prepping for it, don't you?
No.
No.
I have, for me, I have a lot of other responsibilities with the department, but working for a government agency, it really is cyclical around the legislative session, because then once the laws are enacted, we're responsible as an agency for writing and filing the rules to implement them and just keeping government going by administering the tax laws, you know?
There you go.
Yeah.
Scott?
Yeah, things right after the session, I generally write a number of reports for clients, so that takes a while. When that's done, things do tend to get a little bit slower in the summer, although I'm at a large law firm, so there seems to always be something to do. But then there is a lot of ramping up for the next session, and that may be working on rulemaking, you know, providing input if there's rules being written that affect clients, or just planning for the next legislative session. I've got a client that's an insurance trade association. Insurance is both heavily regulated by state government and highly complex, and so that takes a lot of work to get ready for a lot of those issues, and literally we'll spend months and months of meetings and planning and discussion to try to get ready for the next legislative session.
With a long list of clients like you have, are there times where there's conflicting interest in the people you represent?
You know, that we've tried to be careful on the front end when we take on engagements with clients to make sure, first of all, that there's no structural conflict between the clients, and we've declined to represent folks because of the fear of that. We've been very lucky that it happens very rarely. And if there is a situation where a potential conflict comes up, what we'll usually do, or the usual situation, is that it's a really important issue for one client and maybe a second tier or lesser issue with another client. We'll call up the client where maybe it's a little lesser important and explain the situation, ask them if they are okay with us going forward. If they are, great. If not, then we'll just back off on the issue completely. And I can't even remember the last time that's happened. So it's been very good. Although we have to constantly watch for that situation to make sure that doesn't happen. You know, we're lawyers and we have ethical duties not to have conflicts of interest with our clients. Thankfully, that hasn't happened too much.
I'd imagine there are times where maybe somebody else has multiple clients and there is that conflict, and they might even have to drop one of the people that they represent.
Well, it's kind of interesting. There, folks who aren't lawyers aren't bound by the lawyer ethical rules. And in fact, I was just at a subcommittee. I will not name names, but two lobbyists who are not lawyers who are partners, they were representing different clients on the same issue, and one was for it and one was against it. And I guess that was fine. I mean, I assume they've talked to their clients, but... So that does happen sometimes up here, that you'll see folks who are at work together being on the opposite side of the same issue.
So, Tim, I'm curious. You've been here for almost 10 years, or over 10 years, I guess. Do you have a particularly interesting or outlandish story from your past and your time working here?
Well, I guess one of the things that I've learned and that I really respect about the process is that these legislators are held accountable to their 30,000 constituents back home. So they are very careful when they craft the bill to read the bill. Teams of staff pour over the bills. And I often think back to when Speaker Pelosi said, well, we have to pass the bill so we can see what's in it. And that just seemed to me such an outlandish statement from somebody who's seen both Republicans and Democrats in Iowa work together earnestly at compromise legislation. So that probably is the most stark contrast to me as to how good government works and the compromise that can be forged here compared to what we see in the federal government.
So there hasn't been any calls for reading the passing the bill before it?
I can't speak to that. There quite very well could have been, but certainly I'm not aware of any. I guess one of my most, let's call it biggest learning experiences was one time I sent an email to the speaker's email list heralding the passage of this wonderful legislation, and a member of the other party got up on the floor and said, well, the speaker's already sending out correspondence that says, you know, that this bill passed. Well, guess what? It didn't pass today. And then it kept them in debate for another 2 or 3 hours because they wanted to make a point that this hadn't passed. So that was a good learning experience.
Choose your words wisely.
Yeah, and watch the timing of when you're sending an email hailing something that won't happen for a few hours.
Scott, Victoria?
I will say this. You know, the legislature is 150 members of the legislature, 50 senators and 100 representatives. And like any group of 150 people, there's going to be all sorts, you know, on any way you measure or evaluate them, they're going to vary. But I will say that at the end of the day, the process works pretty well. It's not perfect. You know, I don't leave every legislative session clicking my heels together necessarily. But at the end of the day, the process works really well. Differences are worked out. Really glaring mistakes are fixed. Really stupid ideas get weeded out. And the process does work remarkably well. And I think for folks who are highly cynical about the political process...
There's a lot of them.
Yes, there are a lot of them. And there are certainly some justification to that. But I will tell you, at the Iowa legislature, by and large, these are people of good faith. They may have very different philosophical viewpoints, but they work hard. They work well together at the end of the day to reach compromise. And the process does work, by and large.
All right. Well, thanks so much to my guests, Tim Albrecht with the Governor's Office, and to Scott Sundstrom and Victoria Daniels. Thanks so much for being on River to River today.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from John Pimble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your questions and comments. Contact us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Clay Masters. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thank you.